Hello and welcome to Paradox Podcast, episode 43. 43, can you believe it? Here we are on 43, and this one is entitled The Sacred Nature of Bloody Elephant Seals. And we will be talking about Ezekiel chapter 24, and I'd like to begin with reading verses 15 to 24. We read, "The word of the Lord came to me," being Ezekiel. "And God said, 'Mortal, with one blow, I am about to take away from you the delight of your eyes. Yet you shall not mourn or weep, nor shall your tears run down. Sigh, but not aloud. Make no mourning for the dead. Bind on your turban and put your sandals on your feet. Do not cover your upper lip or eat the bread of mourners.' So I spoke to the people in the morning, and at evening my wife died. And on the next morning I did as I was commanded. Then the people said to me, 'Will you not tell us what these things mean for us, that you are acting this way?' Then I said to them, 'The word of the Lord came to me. Say to the house of Israel, thus says the Lord God, I will profane my sanctuary, the pride of your power, the delight of your eyes, and your heart's desire, and your sons and your daughters whom you left behind shall fall by the sword. And you shall do as I have done. You shall not cover your upper lip or eat the bread of mourners. Your turban shall be on your heads and your sandals on your feet. You shall not mourn or weep, but you shall pine away in your iniquities and groan to one another. Thus Ezekiel shall be a sign to you. You shall do just as he has done. When this comes, then you shall know that I am the Lord your God." I think what so often happens is that when we read the Bible, we have a tendency to forget that the people writing and living through the biblical stories are in fact real people. Ezekiel was a human being, just like you, just like me. And Ezekiel had real fears, insecurities, confidences, triumphs, successes, and failures. Not only that, but Ezekiel felt real pain. And so we have this story of a man named Ezekiel who believes that he has received a vision from God. And in this vision, God says to him, "I'm about to take away the delight of your eyes. And when I do take away the delight of your eyes, Ezekiel, you are not allowed to participate in any of the mourning or weeping rituals that your culture allows for." And so God tells him that he must keep something on his head, that he cannot change his clothes, that he must wear sandals on his feet, and that he is not allowed to eat food that people that are grieving normally eat. Now, this was all part of Jewish culture in order to communicate to other people around you that you were hurting, that you were experiencing loss. And God says, don't do any of that. You may feel all broken inside, Ezekiel, but I need you to be strong. I am about to take away the delight of your eyes. And then what's shocking is in the next verse, we read what the delight of Ezekiel's eyes are. In Ezekiel 24:18, Ezekiel writes, "At evening, my wife died. And on the next morning, I did what I was commanded." Now, this is a difficult passage of scripture. Here we have God, who Christians profess is a God of love, telling a man that he is going to kill his wife and he better not cry about it. And then God kills his wife and Ezekiel does not weep. A question that arises is, why would God do something like this? And surprisingly, God gives an answer. You have to remember that Ezekiel is living in exile. Just a few years ago, he was living in Jerusalem until the Babylonians showed up, destroyed Judah, destroyed Jerusalem, dragged Ezekiel and his fellow countrymen across the desert, and plopped them in Babylon. And once they got to Babylon, the Babylonians told him, "You are no longer Jewish, you are now Babylonian." This was a traumatic experience. This was a heartbreaking experience. This was an experience in which people's sons and daughters had died at the hands of the Babylonians. And God, in order to explain why this was happening to people, made an example out of Ezekiel and said, yes, I am God, and I will take things that you love away from you. God says, I may take your wife from you. I may take your country from you. I may take your religion from you. And I am God, so I have the right to do so. And so God, according to Jewish theology, took the Jews out of Judah and forced them to live in Babylon at the hands of the Babylonians. Now, because these were real human beings, they were crushed. Their spirits were crushed by this horrible defeat in which their friends, brothers, sisters, sons, and daughters had died. And so according to Ezekiel, God talks to Ezekiel and sends this prophet as an example. He kills his wife and says, don't cry about it. And then Ezekiel turns to the people of Judah who are living in exile and says, you are to be like me. Because God has said to us, I will profane my sanctuary, the pride of your power, the delight of your eyes and your heart's desires, and your sons and your daughters whom you left behind shall fall by the sword. Thus Ezekiel, God says, shall be a sign to you. You shall do just as he has done. You shall not eat the bread of those who grieve. You shall not change your clothes. You shall not let other people know that you are in fact hurting, because you have to understand that you got what you deserve. When this comes, then you shall know that I am the Lord your God. And as I read this story, there was a question that formed in my mind. Is this story about God murdering a man's wife the cruelest, the meanest, the most cold portrayal of God in all of the Bible? And as I mentally flip through the stories of the Bible, yes, there are some very cruel understandings of who God is, but few of them compare to God killing a woman, turning to the husband and say, don't cry about this. And when we see this cruel portrayal of God in Ezekiel chapter 24, we so often quickly move on, skip over, gloss over this portion of Scripture because it doesn't sit well with us. Even the most ardent defenders of Scripture, who will tell you that God always acts in love, read a chapter like Ezekiel 24 and say, I don't know why God would do this. Because God doesn't act in love in this story, does he? What on earth do we do with Ezekiel chapter 24? I have found that Ezekiel chapter 24 raises all sorts of interesting, fascinating questions about life, death, loss, and grieving. And so I'd like to talk to you today about those things. As you are listening to me, you may say, why isn't Craig talking about the resurrection? Well, that's because we're going to talk about the resurrection next week when we tackle Ezekiel chapter 37. The resurrection is the cornerstone of Christian faith, and it is important for us to remember that. But I'd like to talk about life, death, loss, and grieving in the midst of the uncertainty of this life. Because everyone on earth deals with death, and so rarely do we talk about how to grieve. So next week, we will discuss the resurrection. But for this week, let's talk about life, death, loss, and grieving. A few weeks ago, my daughter wanted to see pictures of animals. And being a good dad, I didn't want to just show her any pictures. I wanted to show her some amazing movies. And so I've been a fan of the series by BBC Earth known as Planet Earth, and their next series known as Life, and the series after known as Human Planet. But there's one series of theirs that I haven't seen, and it's the series called Frozen Planet, in which they focus on how life survives at the extreme temperatures of the Earth. So I sat down with my daughter to watch Frozen Planet, and immediately I felt like I was a candidate for Dad of the Year. The very first animal that shows up is a giant, cuddly, beautiful polar bear. And this polar bear is all alone, and my daughter loved it. She was so excited to see him because she loves animals. And so they show this polar bear walking around on ice, and they have these giant helicopter sweeping shots where you can look for miles around and see nothing alive except for a lonely polar bear. After a few moments, the narrator came on and said a few words about the polar bear. He taught us that the male polar bear was one of the most isolated animals on Earth. They would wander around for miles by themselves until it was time to mate. Now, at this point, I got a little bit nervous because I hadn't really introduced my daughter to the topic of reproduction. She's 2. And so I realized all of a sudden that we're probably going to have some very interesting talks very soon. And so after this polar bear is plodding along on the ice by itself for a while, David Attenborough tells us a little bit about this polar bear. Maya looks at me, my daughter, and says, "What's he doing, Daddy?" And I said, "Well, he's looking for a friend. He's lonely, Maya." And so after some time, we finally see a female polar bear, and my daughter is excited. "A friend, Daddy!" And I say, "Oh no, this is going to get interesting." Now, I did not know this before I watched the show, but apparently, polar bears like to reproduce at high altitudes. So this series, Frozen Planet, shows this male polar bear and this female polar bear climbing up a mountain. They're slipping, they're sliding on the way down, they're trying their best to climb this treacherous peak. And then when they get to the top, the soundtrack changes to this. And then sure enough, my daughter and I watched polar bears do it. Maya asked me the same question. "What's he doing, Daddy?" And I just said, Maya, he's hugging. They're hugging each other. That's what they do. They hug each other. She said, "Oh, okay." Now here's where polar bears are a bit different than humans. Because while they're reproducing, David Attenborough says, another male polar bear has smelled the scent of a female, and he is jealous of the male polar bear. And so the reason that polar bears reproduce at such high altitudes is so they can spot another male polar bear coming from a long ways away. So the current male polar bear who's got the female sees another male polar bear coming toward him, and he stops doing his business and descends the mountain toward this other polar bear. He's got to defend his mate after all. And so these polar bears start charging at each other. And then once they get to each other, they start biting, clawing, scratching, hitting each other as hard as they can. And it is getting extremely bloody. My daughter says, "What's he doing, Daddy?" And I said, he wants a friend. He doesn't like to share his friend. You'll all learn about this very soon. And these polar bears are dripping with blood. And when you have a white polar bear that's dripping with blood, like, you can see where all of the blood is. And so the original male polar bear ends up fighting off this challenger polar bear. And then he climbs the mountain back to reproduce, but he's like bloody. He's limping up to the top and he's exhausted, but he gets to the top. He proceeds to do it with the female polar bear until another challenger arrives. And then this bloody limping polar bear goes down from the mountain and fights the next challenger. And he does this over and over and over again. And it's just frightening to watch. As frightening as it is, though, it is much tougher to watch with your 2-year-old daughter because you try to explain the way the world works to this young mind. Eventually, they finally cut away from the polar bear, and I feel a wave of relief. But then they go to some wolves, and David Attenborough, the narrator, says, "These wolves are hungry." And I just say, "Oh man, this just won't stop." And we watch as a pack of wolves hunts down a crippled bison and eats him. My daughter turns to me and asks the same question. "What are they doing, Daddy?" And I turn to her and I say, "Well, the wolves were hungry and they needed something to eat, so they ate the bison." And she didn't really understand because she's never really been introduced to the concept of death. And so my 2-year-old daughter said, "You mean he fell down?" And I say, "Yes, the bison fell down." And they cut away from the bison and I feel a wave of relief. I say, "Okay, now we can just see some animals doing their thing." And they cut from the bison to some elephant seals. Now, before I watched this program, I knew nothing about elephant seals. But female elephant seals like to travel in packs, in herds, in pods. I don't know what you call a group of female elephant seals. But they travel together and they end up on the same beach together. And they usually travel in packs, pods, herds of about 60. And then the lonely, isolated male elephant seal somehow finds this beach filled with 60 females, and he claims the beach for his own, and he reproduces with as many females as possible. But this guy doesn't like to share, because another elephant seal will come out of the water, see the 60 elephant seals on the beach, see the one male elephant seal and say, I need to challenge that guy for all of these different elephant seals. And they fight, and it's a bloody fight. You see teeth flying, you see like blood dripping down. They are just slugging the crap out of each other with their mouths, with their heads. It is just a vicious fight. And I'm sitting there thinking like, wow, nature is rated R. And I felt bad showing my 2-year-old daughter a nature video because the world was much more vicious than anything she had seen before. And as you watch these different programs, and especially as you watch these programs with a child, you come to a realization that death is not an interruption to life, but death is intrinsic to life. Death is not something that you might have to deal with. Death is something that all living things have to deal with. It is part of the way this world works. I do not know one single person who has never had to deal with death. And as we talk about how humans deal with death differently than animals, because we have a response to death, which is grief. We grieve when we lose something. And when this death that is inevitable, when this death that is intrinsic to life occurs within us, we respond by grieving. But we rarely talk about how to grieve. Every person deals with loss, and yet parents' natural reaction toward their children is not to teach them about that loss, but rather shield them from that loss. Schools don't really teach you how to grieve. They're much more concerned with how to live. And when you think about the way churches and religious institutions deal with grief, the answer is usually, well, just trust in God more and pray that Jesus returns. But we rarely talk about how to grieve and what you should expect to experience when you go through a loss. So in order for us to talk about grief today, I reached out to people that actually knew how to grieve and how to teach others to grieve. And the people that I knew that talked specifically about this thing all referred me to the same teaching, which was this grief model by a duo named Bowlby and Parks. Now, when they sent it to me and they walked me through it, I found it immensely helpful, and I wondered, why don't more people teach this grief model? It gives anyone who is feeling any sense of loss a bit of a map and a bit of a language to help understand what is going on within them. And so Bowlby and Parks break up grief into 4 different phases. And the first phase is called shock and numbness. In response to loss, reality becomes shrouded in fog, and the person that is experiencing this loss feels shocked or they feel numb. This is marked by denial, confusion, resentment, and sorrow. And it's almost like the news of this loss is so overwhelming, there's no clear way to feel anything. And if you were to first hear about a loved one's passing, you would respond by not knowing which way was up and which way was down, or what was necessarily the next move. You might be able to survive and even plan a memorial service, but you may not know what you should be feeling at a memorial service. Because of the shock and numbness phase, it makes sense why people might go to a funeral for a loved one and not cry, because it hasn't really sunk into them yet. The reality isn't really feeling like reality. Now, you can embrace this shock and numbness and allow it to wave through you, or you can fight it and deny it. The problem is, if we deny it or fight it, we will be unable to communicate our emotions and experience an emotional shutdown. If we rush to quickly have answers and to tell everyone that we're okay, even if we're not, then it will lead to a point where you don't really feel like people hear you later on when you start to communicate those feelings. After shock and numbness, the second phase sets in of grieving. This phase is known as yearning and searching, and it's marked by an intense longing for the way things were. Now, this is generally more of an emotionally felt expectation than an intellectually believed one. In other words, the heart overpowers the mind. If someone is going through the yearning and searching phase, they are hoping that they misunderstood the information that this person passed away or has left their life. It's like a husband who may think that he sees his deceased wife in a crowd, or that husband may hope that when his phone rings, that he looks down at the caller ID and sees it's her name. Or this same husband may hear the door open and secretly hope that it's his wife. Now, he can rationally explain why this is insane or why this is crazy and why he shouldn't be feeling these things, but he's in the yearning and searching phase and he emotionally wants it to be his wife. Now, this doesn't mean that he's crazy. He's just grieving. And when you grieve properly, you grieve in a way that has an intense longing for the way things were. Now, if we deny this phase, we become obsessed with filling the void of that person in our lives. Instead, if this happens to any of us, if we ever hear the phone ringing and think, oh man, I hope it's them, and you know that person isn't with us anymore, you shouldn't fight it and say, oh, how could I be so dumb? How could I be so stupid? No. Instead, say it's okay. I have a longing for the way things were. And this is how humans process loss. And it's valuable. Don't deny the yearning and searching phase. Yearning and searching then give way to phase three, and phase three is known as despair and disorganization. This is when the permanence of the loss becomes tangible. Now, while the last phase, yearning and searching, is more of an active kind of grieving, if you're in the despair and disorganization phase, you find that the reaction is much more lethargic or passive. This is when menial tasks like the dishes don't get done, or the lawn doesn't get mowed, or you have a hard time getting out of bed. This is because you've started to give up hope that you've misheard the information, and you realize that you are now going to have to build a life without what you once had. And this is all normal. Now, if we deny this phase and refuse to accept the permanence of this loss, we will become angry, depressed, and lead a life of bitterness. We'll be sarcastic toward other people who are celebrating joys and triumphs in their lives because you'll always wonder why it never happened to you. And the key to letting go of your despair is to live in it. The key to letting go of this darkness is to journey further into it. And so when you live in the despair and disorganization phase, yes, it's hard, and you may question whether God exists, and you may say to yourself, this whole faith thing doesn't work for me anymore. And all that Bowlby and Parks would say to you is, yes, that's normal. We understand. And so the key is to not fight it, but to embrace it. Because eventually it will give way to reorganization and recovery, the fourth phase of grieving. Now, this is marked by a turn toward the future, where you begin to have faith in life again, where you begin to pick up the pieces and reorganize your life around what has changed before. And this is when you start to believe, start to feel that you can experience joy again. Now, a danger with this grief model is that you can think it's something to help you move on. The truth is, it's impossible to move on from grief. There is only moving forward. And as Randy Spire, who's got a doctorate in counseling, told me, he said, I have found that most grieving moves forward and backward, lives in one stage for longer durations and other stages for shorter durations. And some stages happen more than once. Grief, like life and love, is often messy and a life journey. And so we have the Bowlby and Parks grief model that helps us understand how we should grieve. With phase one, shock and numbness, phase two, yearning and searching, phase three, despair and disorganization, and phase four, reorganization and recovery. With that in mind, let's return to Ezekiel chapter 24. Here we have a man who has a wife, and God shows up and says, your wife is going to die, and you are going to feel an enormous amount of pain. And what it's almost like God is saying is he's saying to Ezekiel, whatever you do, Ezekiel, don't feel shock and numbness. If you do, it will be a sign that you distrust my will. Whatever you do, Ezekiel, don't let others see you yearning and searching. If you do, it will be a sign of weak faith. But God keeps going. He says, Ezekiel, whatever you do, don't despair. Don't be disorganized. If you do, then I, the Lord your God, might misinterpret that for doubt in my resurrection. And then God closes by saying, whatever you do, just get back to life as normal as soon as possible. This is the mark of strong faith. And Ezekiel hears this from God and says, yes, Lord, I will obey. When we look at what Ezekiel 24 is saying, is that Ezekiel 24 is pointing at the Bowlby and Parks model, and it's a story about how all of that model is a sign of distrust in God. To journey into the heart of grief is anti-God, according to Ezekiel 24. This chapter in the Bible teaches us that God's true followers don't grieve. And this theology is still dominant in Western Christianity. Have you ever been to a funeral, a Christian funeral? Because I have. And something that I hear so often is that when somebody presents something about the deceased and they don't cry, they are admired as if they are a hero. I've heard so many people say things like, oh man, it must have been so hard for that person to say those things about that person and not cry about it. What composure. She was so poised. And what that's communicating is, if you're strong in light of grief rather than feeling it, that you're a stronger believer in God. And it's right in line with Ezekiel chapter 24. Not only that, but I've heard Christians who have gone through a heartbreaking, terrible loss of a loved one, and they turn to the people they know, and the thing they say over and over again is, I just need to trust in the Lord more. Why would they say that? Well, it's because they believe Ezekiel 24, which teaches that God's true followers don't grieve. Another example is, I've heard evangelists tell me that if we have more faith as a collective global society, then Jesus Christ will return and take us away from pain and suffering. Well, what this evangelist is really getting at is that if we just have more faith, then we won't feel pain. And if we take Ezekiel 24 by itself, all of these people are correct, because Ezekiel 24 teaches us that God's true followers don't grieve. They don't mourn. They don't cry. Instead, they trust in the Lord. And so this theology is written down, preserved, and called holy. And then Jesus shows up. And Christians believe that the most complete, best understanding we have of God is when God became incarnate, when God took on blood and flesh and walked among us as a human being and showed humanity how to live. In the midst of all of this, Jesus gives the Sermon on the Mount. And it is powerful because in there he says these words, knowing full well what is in Ezekiel chapter 24. He says, blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. The predominant theology of Jesus's day was that the true followers of God do not grieve, do not mourn, do not weep. And Jesus says, no. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are those who grieve, for they will be comforted. Holy are those who mourn. Holy are those who grieve. Not only that, but in the Gospel of John, we hear a story about how Jesus's friend Lazarus passes away. And Jesus responds, the Son of God responds by weeping. This is shocking, earth-shattering, life-changing, because it shows that God is not anti-grieving, but in fact, God is a God who grieves. Now, the Desert Fathers picked up on this, and in particular, a man named Saint Ephrem the Syrian picked up on it and said, the freedom to cry is a clear sign that you have actually experienced God. And so when we look at the Bowlby and Parks model of shock and numbness, yearning and searching, despair and disorganization, reorganization and recovery, Ezekiel looks at it and says, God isn't there. He's not among those things. If you want to find God, avoid all of those stages. But Jesus shows up and says, well, actually, I am here. I have gone through all of these phases. And whether you are in shock and numbness or yearning and searching, despair and disorganization, reorganization and recovery, or any other stage, Jesus says, I have gone through all of them and I am there with you as well. Now, if this seems like a contradiction and that Jesus is going against the ways of Ezekiel, then I have to tell you that you are right. This is a contradiction in the Bible. And you could say, how can that be? Because you have God telling Ezekiel one thing in chapter 24, And then Jesus showing up and saying the exact opposite of that. Did God change God's mind? What happened here? And why did God do a 180? Well, you have to remember what Jesus came to earth to do. Because the predominant understanding of who Jesus was that he came to this earth to change the mind of God about humans. God was filled with wrath toward human beings and couldn't wait to smite them off the face of the earth because they were so sinful. And so the predominant understanding of why Jesus took on blood and flesh was to show up and say, look, God, calm down. These people aren't that bad. Take all of your wrath and anger out on me instead. I'll be the substitute. I will take their place. But when you really read the stories and the life and the gospels of Jesus Christ, you realize that's not what he's getting at. Jesus did not come to change the mind of God about humans. Instead, Jesus came to change the mind of humans about God. He was constantly working with humans who had all these understandings and teachings and scriptures about how God worked the way that God worked and who God was. And he said, oh, I see, you've been told this, but today I tell you something different. And he always, in massive theological shifts, shows up and changes the way that human beings perceive and understand God. Namely, people thought that God liked one race of people better than everyone else. And Jesus is like, no, it's not who God is. God doesn't work that way. In fact, God is most present not when you love each other, but when you love your enemies. Jesus did this because Jesus came to change the mind of humans about God, not the other way around. And so when you have these phases and this grief model, Ezekiel saying, you know what, Christians don't grieve. Jesus shows up and says, well, actually, the presence of God is found in grieving. And the thing that's so inspiring about the life of Jesus Christ is that people were so quick to point out where God wasn't. And Jesus said, well, actually, God is there. When somebody said, well, you know, God could never love those people, Jesus showed how God did love those people. When people were grieving, and that was looked down upon by some people with theology, Jesus said, actually, they're in the presence of God with their tears. And so when we think about what Jesus is saying to us today is that if you have experienced a loss in your life, and it's a real recent loss, and you are currently in the phase of shock and numbness, and you're not sure which way is up and which way is down, and you can't really process any feelings, and everybody's trying to talk to you and bring you stuff, and you just really can't make sense of anything, and you feel weak, and you feel insecure, and you're not sure what to feel, and you think about God, and you say, well, where is God in the midst of this? Jesus calmly says, I am here with you today. Perhaps you're in the yearning and searching phase. And you hear a knock on the door and you hope it's your lost loved one. You hear your phone ringing and you frantically reach for it, hoping it's that person to finally make amends. And it's not. And you know they're not going to call you back. And you feel shame for believing that things can work out. Maybe you're at a Thanksgiving dinner just recently and you set an extra place at the table in hopes that it was all a bad dream. Jesus Christ, the Son of God, does not say to you, snap out of it, move on already. Can you just hurry along with it? Jesus calmly says, I am here with you. God is found in our moments of yearning and searching. Maybe you're in the despair and disorganization phase, and life is too cruel, and you're just starting to realize how permanent this loss is in your life, and you can barely go on. You can barely make it out of bed. You can barely survive. And when other people tell you that you need to have more faith and that you need to trust God in the resurrection, you think in your head, I'm not even sure that God is good. I'm not sure that God exists. I'm not sure that I will see my loved one again. Jesus shows up and does not tell you, get right with God. Jesus shows up and does not say, turn or burn. Jesus does not show up and say, how could you not believe in the resurrection? Jesus shows up, puts his arm around you, feels your despair and says, I am here with you. Or perhaps you're in the reorganization recovery and you're just starting to put your life back together and you are afraid to move on because you don't want to forget the love this person has given you in the past, but you know you have to move forward. And you find that grief is not a linear path to moving forward, but it is in fact a path where you take steps backwards someday, and it's three steps forward and two steps back. Jesus shows up in the midst of all of this, and he doesn't say, how could you be back on this feeling? I thought we moved on already. Jesus sits down and calmly says, I am here with you. Let's take this one day at a time. Because Western Christianity will tell you over and over and over again that to grieve is to show doubt in God and his resurrection. But Jesus Christ always shows up, looks at whatever stage you are at, and calmly whispers, the ability to grieve is holy. And when you are willing to grieve and to mourn and to weep, then you are not at opposition with God, but you are side by side with God. The ability to grieve is holy. As you go through this holiday season, may you be assured that when you miss someone, whether it's been 1 year or 20 years, that Jesus Christ misses them as well. God is found in our ability to grieve. Grace and peace to you, my friends.